Come, spell weavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and tonight we are going to get controversial. It's going to get spicy. It is going to be a conversation tonight. I say this and re-emphasize it over and over again because every time I say something is going to be controversial and spicy, I always get the most tepid reaction to it. So here's hoping no one actually comes after me about this, but this is going to be a controversial one for some of you out there. Because I'm being joined once again by Greg Lambert, the creator of the Chronicles of Iris, and we are going to be talking about the idea that fantasy is inherently conservative, that it has inherently traditional values to it. So before we get into that, just want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy this kind of content, especially if you like your burritos as spicy as this one is going to be tonight. And also want to remind everyone that you can find us here on the various social media on X and Instagram. I am at @Howard_RyanGreg. On YouTube, it is Rollin' Bones. And on Twitch, it is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And of course, you can find my articles over on Substack, rollinbones.substack.com. And if you enjoy the show and want to support me by buying some merch, you can do so over on TeePublic. I'm going to go ahead and drop the links to TeePublic and Substack in chat right now for those of you who want to see it. I'm not going to show it tonight because I have gotten tired of showing them. You guys know what they look like. You can find them in the links there in chat. And those of you who are watching after the fact, you can find those links in the pinned comment. That is enough of my nonsense. I want to go ahead and remind everyone to follow at Iris Chronicles over on Twitter. And let's bring on the man himself, Greg Lambert, the creator of Iris Chronicles. Greg, welcome to Rollin' Bones.
Hello. I'm glad to be on here a second time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is something that you actually first brought up in that bastion of free thought and expression and philosophy that is the Basic Experts Gilded server.
Yes, a private server from which nothing should be shared ethically anyway. Mm-hmm.
It's our own private group of friends sharing their own thoughts and ideas about gaming and philosophy and mayonnaise. And if you're cool enough, we might just invite you to join it. But, you know, again, if you're cool enough. But anyways, you first shared this idea that when I first heard it kind of shocked me. And I didn't really think I agreed with it. But then I kept thinking about it. And then you explained it. And it's this idea that fantasy as a genre, as a whole kind of totality of storytelling, is inherently traditional or conservative in some way. So I want to hear you kind of lay out your thesis there, and then we'll kind of dig into the specifics around this topic.
Okay. Well, I don't think it's going to be as spicy as we proposed at in the intro. Hopefully not. This is it's not just my idea. Certainly great fantasy and literature authors from the past century have posited this. J.R.R. Tolkien writes extensively about it. I have his On Fairy Stories essay pulled up here, from which I have taken a little bit of reference, where he talks about the various forms of fantasy, its functions from the absolute lowest to the highest function of fantasy. But back in high school, which was, for me, 24 years ago, I had this idea then, which back then I called it, now this is very silly, but I called it pure fantasy. And me and my friends had this big idea of a pure fantasy. Like, what is the highest fantasy? Like, what is it supposed to be? And that was before I had even read On Fairy Stories or any of the other, you know, I had read some Appendix N stuff, but I wasn't, like, super duper, like, into, you know, fantasy and the whole history of it, history of the genre and literature. But the idea for us was that there must be some kind of connection to mythology and folklore. And I think we can all agree that fantasy must inherently have some kind of connection to mythology and folklore. That's part of what the surface level of what defines fantasy as a genre, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
But it also must tie to history, okay? Because you can't really have, I mean, you can have folklore without history. You have modern folklore, and there's a lot of literature out there, a young adult fantasy that focuses entirely on current modern day, you know, whatever, urban folklore. That's fine. I would consider that a slightly lesser version of fantasy. But when you are talking about the core of fantasy, as you and I think of it in our minds when we hear the term fantasy, it's kind of a fairy tale genre where an entire world is created. Tolkien called it subcreation. That's consistent with reality, but it has its own reality. And it presents certain ideals and concepts within that are derived from history and from mythology. So that's where my idea, my thesis comes from. Is fantasy conservative? And I feel like the answer must be yes. And not from a, is fantasy a Donald Trump MAGA hat wearing, you know, phenomenon? Certainly not. Although you can kind of draw some ephemeral threads between the idea of fantasy and modern political conservatism. There are, you know, you can't completely sever all of those threads. There are some, of course, because we're talking about cultural ideas and values and mores that have been lost or are from the past and people want to bring back, or at least are looking to the past for inspiration for the present. And that, I feel, is part of the reason for fantasy to exist. So that's why, just in a nutshell, I believe fantasy must be traditional and must be conservative, because the purpose of fantasy is to draw from our mythological past in order to paint an idea of life and of the human experience based on broader, more eternal ideology, concepts of good and evil, things that speak to us from, you know, the broad scope of human history, and not looking towards the future. We're not looking towards what could be coming down the pipeline for humanity, like science fiction. So it's not progressive. You know, science fiction is very progressive. It's looking towards the future. Fantasy looks towards the past. And if you're inherently looking towards the past, I believe you must be inherently traditional. Mm-hmm. So that's just the basic foundation for the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And you really kind of answered my first question there in your explanation, because when you say the word conservative, because of the like politics of the modern day, there's a lot of baggage that comes with that term. And I think it'd be fair to say a majority of that baggage has nothing to do with your actual definition of conservative.
Right, as Orcus Dorcas RPG Shenanigans has said here, what definition of traditionally conservative are you basing this on? You can be traditional and hold these concepts to heart without being conservative. I think he's speaking of the political connotation that you and I are hinting at here with the MAGA hat-wearing type of political, you know, slant. That's not really what I mean. I kind of, I guess, equate traditionalism with conservatism in this instance, in that we're simply looking towards values from the past. And in fantasy, as a genre, I believe it's looking to values that come from, that cannot exist in modern day. So let's look at some history here. So if we're talking about fantasy as a genre, we obviously go back to Tolkien, and we go back to C.S. Lewis, and we go back to these greats of the 20th century. And we're getting into some Appendix N type of stuff as well. Edgar Rice Burroughs. We're getting into Fritz Leiber to a certain extent, and you know, Jack Vance and Paul Anderson and all these greats. But it goes even older than that. We have G.K. Chesterton and William Morris, and we have Lord Dunsany, Elfland's Daughter, and some of the stuff that happened even before Tolkien's time. Well, Tolkien was not the end-all be-all of fantasy. It had existed many, many years before him.
So you probably throw George MacDonald in there as well.
Right, right. So what do we find in the most influential and most important fantasy in history? I'm not just talking about the 20th century. I'm talking about in history. What do we find here in these authors? Well, obviously, they are almost entirely Christian authors, right? And so that's not because they're explicitly creating Christian literature. Sometimes they were. C.S. Lewis was, G.K. Chesterton certainly was, and Tolkien, to a certain degree, was, although you can argue that Middle Earth is a pagan world in which there is a foundation of a Christian value system, which Tolkien intended for it to be. He did disagreed with C.S. Lewis's metaphor in the Chronicles of Narnia. But that's just because that was considered normal, right?
Yeah.
In Western society, Europe, most of Europe and the United States, South and North America, Christianity was just considered part and parcel for everyday life for writers and everyone else prior to the 1960s. Most of, if not all of the fantasy literature that we get from that time is derived from Christian authors and contains ideas of good versus evil, kind of you know, eternal ideals that are meant to exist from the past to the present and the future, you know, not something that's supposed to be improved upon through progress. It's not something that's supposed to be changed and twisted and turned into something new through examination, scientific inquiry, or anything of that nature. Right, and that's the type of conservatism I'm talking about here. It's values from the past, derived from older systems of morality that are drawn upon to influence the present day. And, you know, and most people, and that was, of course, before the 1960s, get the rise of communism, postmodernism, and that type of thing. That's a whole bag I don't really want to get into because I'm not a super expert on that. But we do see a slight decline in that foundation for fantasy as we move later on into the 20th century. It did come back in the 80s. I know a lot of guys like Jeff Rowe and you know, some of the other guys say not to read anything after 1980. Well, you know, we look at Dragonlance, written by authors who were extremely Christian, at least in their foundation. Mm-hmm. I think they're Latter-day Saints or what were they?
Yeah, I believe they're a Mormon persuasion.
Yeah, they're definitely Mormon. But, I mean, it does come back in time to time. Mm. Now, not to continue rambling, but I am not saying that fantasy must be Christian. Certainly not. It can be pagan. Pagan is also a very conservative, very traditional idea. But it also has morality. Paganism is not without morality. If you go back and look at the past, even before Christianity took hold, certainly there were extensive tomes of knowledge and wisdom that we take from pagan ancestry that has a lot of like core eternal idealism in it.
Right.
But, you know, paganism, Christianity, anything in between, if you were writing a fairy story or a fantasy tale that draws from that mythology from the past 2,000 years or more, essentially, you are conservative. You must be conservative because you are looking to the past and not to the present or the future.
Yeah. Now, Scott leaves another comment here. Still feel that you can be traditional and carry traditions to heart without being a non-political conservative, just as you can be religious without being conservative. And I think it's important again to kind of, you know, reiterate here. This term it's a very difficult one to deal with in kind of the like modern times. I kind of understand what you're getting at there, Scott, but I don't know. I can't quite go all the way where you're going with this comment, because if you are holding on to tradition is placing a high value on the past and doing things in a certain way because they've been done this way over and over again. And if you hold on to anything from the past, you really can't consider yourself anything other than a conservative, even in a non-political sense, because I mean, the idea of, like, the antithesis of conservatism is progressivism, and I'm saying this, again, in a non-political sense, because progressivism is pushing past what is behind us, because it's behind us, and looking forward. Conservatism is looking backward toward what worked in the past, whereas progressivism is trying to find what will work in the future. I don't know if I'm explaining myself here, you know, very well, but if you are holding on to any vestige of tradition, you can't fully say that you're not a conservative in that regard.
Yeah, and I would say it's not even fantasy. It's not looking towards what worked in the past necessarily. Let's take a look at the example of monarchism. Okay, so, you know, there are a lot of proponents of monarchy. Obviously today, maybe even some in chat, because obviously there's this idiom that says the decisions of a monarch can never be worse than the thoughts of a majority of people. So it's like, you know, the idea of democracy is, you know, considered like not necessarily very conservative to some folks. But monarchism obviously has a lot of problems. Like if you go to feudal life and the abundance of the influence of the church, the Catholic Church, I mean, people did live okay lives during that time, obviously, but there's, you know, there's a ton of things that we would look at today as being like, wow, shit, I don't want to be part of that. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, fantasy must look at these specific political constructions and systems of government and systems of economics. That's too granular for what I'm talking about. I'm talking about almost a romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have the concept of romanticism, which, for better or worse, takes a look at the past and history, mythology, takes the better elements of that and brings it forward, leaving the lesser behind.
Yeah.
Tolkien does this. C.S. Lewis did it. Many, many authors from the early 20th century and beyond could be considered romantic in the fantasy genre.
Mm.
Now, what Crafty Matt has said, I see his comment here, leads into a side conversation of religious themes in science fiction, Dune, Star Wars, etc. I would argue that Star Wars is a fantasy series.
Yeah.
The theme of Star Wars is not in the influence of technology or science on the human condition. It's not about using science to advance the human condition or destroy it, as the case may be, you know, with something like Terminator, hard science fiction. Now, Dune is a different story. Dune definitely goes into the real-world implications of the application of technology. And Dune is very, you know, very complex in that sense. Going into politics, a lot of parallels to, you know, Islam and modern political ideologies and the impact of science on ecology. Ecology is a big theme in Dune. So, yes, definitely Dune is science fiction, but it treats religion as a modern construct, as part of the overall, I hate the word zeitgeist because it makes me seem arrogant, but it's the zeitgeist of the human experience that includes technology, science, socio-political change, culture, religion, all of those things, and it takes a step back and examines that, and it uses it. Now, fantasy doesn't take a step back and examine, we have science over here, we have religion over here, and mythology over here, and we have modern-day culture and language and value systems, and let's go ahead and kind of compare all these and see if they conflict with each other and which one is going to come out on top. That's not what fantasy is really about. Fantasy goes straight for romanticism. It goes straight to the past. It goes straight for the mythology and the history. And it says, ignore all this industry and science and everything that we've developed. And we're going to build a foundation based on something from the past. And Tolkien, I hate to continue referencing Tolkien because there were many fantasy authors who came before him, as I discussed, but he was adamant about this.
Mm.
And Tolkien's ideology is very strange. Like, if you go and look at and read his letters and what he's about, it's hard for me to imagine outside of the Unabomber someone who has an ideology as anti-industrial as Tolkien. Like, he believed in like a pastoral, romantic vision of, you know, Europe, and industry was like a complete failure for humanity and all this other stuff.
I can think of one other person who was equally anti-industrial as Tolkien and Uncle Ted, and that would be Robert E. Howard.
Yes, well, of course. Now, Robert E. Howard is an interesting case. Now, if we're talking about Appendix N, young adult fantasy, I say young adult, it's really adult fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I still think it has that Christian narrative.
Yep.
Even in Robert E. Howard's case, Conan is a man with values and honor. He has honor, and he does not violate that, except in a few. I mean, he does. I mean, there's Conan is a more complex individual than people give him credit for. But Robert E. Howard was, and Robert E. Howard wrote lengthy treatises on where he got the influence for his world and his development. Again, Tolkien talked about fantasy as a sub-creative process, creating a world that drew from the past and from mythology to bring certain concepts to modern audiences. Robert E. Howard did that as well.
Absolutely.
Hyperborea, I mean, he has tons of references to obscure mythological ideas that today, like, no one... Like, people don't even hardly even talk about this stuff. They think it's a conspiracy theory. Like, yeah. Atlantis and, you know, lost lands in the north and stuff like that. So, Robert E. Howard is definitely, I would consider it to be, like, a core fantasy author. Absolutely. In terms of the themes and the overall intent of the work.
Yeah. Now, Scott raises a point here. A while back, and I want to kind of use this as a jumping off point for our conversation.
Okay.
So kind of bear with me here. This is going to be a little rambly, and I'm going to read kind of a long quote to go along with this. Scott says, fantasy is not adverse to change, in my opinion, and isn't that a base for defined conservatism? He says, I hear you. I'm focusing on the non-political. So, what we're going to kind of focus on here for a little bit is fantasy adverse to change? And so to kind of kick off that side of the conversation, I am going to read this often quoted passage of Chesterton's regarding the fence, because I believe that this is essentially the core of philosophical conservatism. So if you all will indulge me for a little bit. In the matter of reforming things, as distinct from deforming them, there is one plain and simple principle, a principle which will probably be called a paradox. There exists in such a case a certain institution or a law, let us say, for the sake of simplicity, a fence or a gate erected across a road. The more modern type of reformer goes gaily up to it and says, I don't see the use of this, let us clear it away. To which the more intelligent type of reformer will do well to answer, if you don't see the use of it, I certainly won't let you clear it away. Go away and think. Then, when you can come back and tell me that you do see the use of it, I may allow you to destroy it. So, with that quote in mind, and with Scott's comment in mind, do you think that fantasy adheres to that kind of philosophical conservatism?
I believe so. I think that to look at the idea of fantasy as unchanging and perhaps concrete or resolute might not necessarily be correct. But we need to look at C.S. Lewis in this case. Okay, so... my number one example is Prince Caspian. Prince Caspian is about a loss of value, a loss of belief, a loss of magic, of the way that the world was, and a reformation or a restoration of those values. And the Chronicles of Iris, which I wrote, which is my D&D setting, is about that as well. Very heavily influenced by Prince Caspian. So what is Prince Caspian talking about here? You know, is the book promoting that the status quo should not be changed? Is it promoting that the past should remain the same? I don't believe so. I think that fantasy looks at problems. Now, we're getting into some modern sociopolitical stuff. I'm sorry, because fantasy is, you know, escapism and a few other things. But if we're going to use fantasy as a method of improving our lives, it would look towards the modern day, and instead of building, using the modern day as a foundation, it would reach to the past to try and reform or restore previous ideas. So, to me, that implies that there is change occurring. There is a big change from the status quo. You know, if we're talking about politics or religion or belief, morality, using ideas from the past to construct a new vision for the future that has more eternal idealism, I feel like that implies some kind of change, some kind of overall shift in the worldview of whatever setting you're talking about here. So yeah, so I don't think fantasy is necessarily static. It does have a lot of change that it can incur, but those changes and those ideas are still very conservative.
Mm. Yeah, and I think this kind of gets into a lot of the fallacies that people have in their minds about the philosophy, the philosophical conservatism. People seem to think that conservatism means no change whatsoever. People generally think of it as a static philosophy. But I think, you know, there's plenty of room for what you might call progress within a conservative framework. It all has to do with what undergirds, like, the foundation on which you're building. It's not about building just for building's sake. It's about building kind of where and when appropriate, and making sure that what you're building has its roots in something strong. So it's not just, you know, knocking down old buildings and throwing up cheap apartment complexes. It's knocking down old buildings that can no longer stand on their own and replacing them with structures that will stand for years and years to come. It's about, you know, getting rid of what can no longer exist and replacing it with something that is going to endure forever. That's kind of the conservative vision of progress, if I can say something that's so kind of contradictory to a lot of people's images of you know, the conservative philosophy. It's not about staying the same and never changing, never moving beyond 1955 or 1855 or 1755, depending on the conservative that you're talking to. It's about kind of holding on to the values that make for strong people and strong society, and moving forward while holding on to those values as best we can. And I do think that a lot of, a majority of fantasy holds to that. And to kind of answer what Scott is saying about, you know, things like Dying Earth and, Elric, I think a lot of the, you know, stuff that's not what would be generally be considered conservative, a lot of it is playing with the genre of fantasy. It's not what you would call kind of strict fantasy. It's a lot of kind of, you know, messing with some of the trappings of the genre, which kind of gets into another question that I have for you. When we talk about fantasy as a genre, what do we mean by that? How do we kind of place this genre as a whole? Like, what defines it, in your mind at least?
Sure, we can talk about that. First, though, I'd like to address the comment by Nick Laserbeam. If you just look at the Lord of the Rings, fantasy had ideally masculine men fighting against something horrible to save humanity through the lens of Tolkien's experience in the Great War. And then he later goes and says, with that being the most influential fantasy work of all time, fantasy is definitely, I hereby say, is conservative and inherently masculine. Would I agree? Probably. But I think you must also understand And surely you do, that Tolkien's definition of masculinity was much, much different than what we see today.
Right.
I mean, Frodo and Sam and the hobbits had a deep sense of bravery, loyalty, and honor, but they were not Chads. Like, they were not the Chad meme, you know, Giga Chad. They weren't like a 4chan meme. Like, they weren't like super manly men. You know, obviously, Olonius and Gimli had their contests of how many orcs they could kill, and Aragorn was a very princely and downtrodden character who had a stoicism about him. But Tolkien's idea of masculinity came from his faith, which was about humbleness. It was about honor in the face of extreme adversity. So yeah, I do agree that there is that element there, but it's not from a perspective that we would normally see from, you know, just modern internet and like Twitter and that type of thing. You have to look at it differently. But yeah, so how do we define fantasy? Very good question. Wikipedia says it's a genre of speculative fiction that involves magical elements. Set in a fictional universe, inspired by mythology and folklore, so it does give a concession to that. So it says that it must be that. I don't necessarily believe that it must be magical. Certainly not. Is Conan the Barbarian a magical series? Is it a magical storyline? Sure, there are magic or supernatural elements are included, you know, pretty frequently in Conan the Barbarian, but if you stripped those out, would it no longer be fantasy? Of course it would still be fantasy, even without any reference to supernatural elements, gods or magic or spells or wizards or any of that. It would still be fantasy because it still looks to the past, and mythology doesn't necessarily have to include magic. It can include great heroes. It can include, Ulysses or Odysseus or Achilles. You know, those are great stories that have magic and gods, but stripped away, you can still have those character elements that are from a different time and represent different ideals that could not exist today, or perhaps they could, and that is kind of the definition of fantasy, is like, what can we make of today from the past? Now, if we look at Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, which is too long to even go into really the whole thing, he believes that the highest function of fantasy is something that he calls the eucatastrophe, which is a consolation of the happy ending. So it's a kind of joy or sudden joyous turn, or not necessarily escapist, but a feel that you get from fantasy or a fairy tale as a sudden miraculous grace that occurs at the end of the story, where you get a glimpse of a greater world, very poignant, a higher understanding of the fate and of the destiny of mankind, you know, that type of thing. Tolkien believed that that was the highest goal of fantasy, to achieve that. So I think you can kind of combine some of those ideas and say that, yes, fantasy is there as a genre. To define fantasy, it would be a mythological story that reaches to the past in order to capture eternal ideology that causes the reader or the audience to feel a sense of joy and excitement about transitioning to a more transcendental state. That sounds a little, art house. I'm not trying to be, you know, too academic about it, but when I say that, it means you're actually getting like this feeling of you're seeing something else. You're kind of seeing beyond into a larger world, as Obi-Wan would say. You've taken your first steps into a larger world.
Right.
That's probably the meaning of fantasy.
Mm. Yeah, and to kind of bring up some of the objections that we're getting here in chat, I mean, specifically, like Robert Irwin saying, that's the wrong one. If it's not based on reality, then it's fantasy. This is one of the frustrating things about the idea of fantasy as a genre, specifically with that label on it. I wish we could almost go back in time and change the genre label that was given to this genre, because the word fantasy, like outside of a literary context, literally just means a fanciful mental image, typically one on which a person dwells at length or repeatedly and which reflects their conscious or unconscious wishes. That's from the Oxford Dictionary. And that's just one of the definitions, but all the definitions listed for fantasy have some kind, they basically just mean imaginary. So when you're dealing with a genre of fiction, all fiction is fantasy by that definition. But if we're to define these stories by something other than they're imaginary, which we have to in order to separate them from other types of fiction, then we have to draw the line somewhere. And I think this is a good place to draw that line. And to continue kind of addressing the reasons why kind of, Dying Earth and Elric aren't necessarily what you'd consider true fantasy, like Crafty Matt said, they are based on nihilism. Specifically Elric, and I think this gets into why, and I'm going to commit kind of role-playing heresy here. I have a lot of trouble reading Elric, because when I read Elric, all I get is just potent fumes of nihilism, and I don't like it.
It certainly doesn't contain the catastrophe that Tolkien was talking about there.
Right.
I consider Elric to be... Elric is fantasy in the same way that Akira is cyberpunk.
Mm.
So what I mean by that is Akira, and hopefully most of you know what Akira is often considered probably one of the top three cyberpunk like movies or pieces of media of all time. But in actuality, it's not cyberpunk at all.
Right.
It influenced the aesthetic of cyberpunk tremendously, but the core themes of Akira are not cyberpunk. There's nothing cyber about Akira. Mm. It's not about the influence of the internet and computer science on the human condition. It has the punk. It definitely has the punk element, but it's missing that neuromancer level of discourse about the interaction between humanity and computers. That is the core of cyberpunk. Akira doesn't have it. Similarly, Elric has a ton of fantasy motif, aesthetic influence by fantasy, but it's a different beast. It's an entirely different beast. I'm not saying it's not fantasy. I'm just saying that it's not it's a lesser form of fantasy and more of a higher form of pulp fiction or even pulp like science fantasy or something that we would see later on in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, and by that same extension, I would say that Dying Earth is... It has a fantasy aesthetic to it, but the core of Dying Earth is... What happens when humanity becomes so divorced from technology that it kind of loses its connection with it and kind of begins to see it in the way that Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, because we've forgotten in the world of Dying Earth, because we've forgotten how technology, how mathematics works, it becomes like magic. So that's where I feel like that's where Dying Earth kind of strays from what you would call traditional fantasy.
Yeah, and fantasy like like Elric is almost limiting itself in a certain way. Because if you are, let's pretend that some of our premises are correct, that fantasy must be conservative in that it reaches into the past to pull eternal values from mythology and history and bring those to the forefront, then Elric has some of the aesthetics of fantasy, and it's almost like the story of Elric is shackled to that. Michael Moorcock felt, it almost feels like he's compelled to have a fantasy world without necessarily, like, understanding why. I'm not denigrating the man, obviously he's a genius, but it's like he's, and that's a problem with a lot of fantasy that we have today. A modern young adult fantasy, even something like Harry Potter, is compelled to create a world that has mythological or fantasy elements, but it doesn't always understand why those elements are present, and it doesn't use them to their full potential. And that's a reason why I believe, personally, that the fantasy literature of the early 20th century is always going to be superior to anything that we get today, whether it's Malazan, or In the Name of the Wind, or in any of these modern series are great. Mm-hmm. But some of the core values are lost.
Right. Yeah. And to answer some of the questions that we're still getting here, Robert Irwin, if conservative fantasy seems kind of oxymoronic, why? Why does it seem oxymoronic? I'm genuinely curious. I want to hear your explanation, because I'd actually like to kind of go in that direction here in just a little bit. And then Orcus Dorcas again, the topic is not traditional fantasy is conservative, but fantasy is conservative. We have to define, we have to set a base for what fantasy is. And we use the term traditional fantasy to define this is baseline fantasy. Anything that deviates from baseline, like, again, that's the baseline of fantasy that we're trying to set here is, you know, we're arguing that the baseline is conservative. And when you deviate from that baseline, it becomes a question of, is it still, you know, truly pure fantasy at that point? And because you're deviating, I would say no. And right. I think Greg would agree with that. So
I would
That's why I feel it's relevant to keep coming back to using the word traditional fantasy and what is traditional, because, you know, deviation from that is deviation. And then at that point, you're not dealing with pure fantasy anymore.
Yeah, so what we're dealing with, it's very difficult because obviously in mainstream culture and pop culture, fantasy has become extraordinarily broad and complex in terms of what people think that it is. So to create this argument that we've kind of defined earlier on in the stream, you have to strip away, I don't know how many years of what pop culture has turned fantasy into. Like, get rid of all these different weird subgenres of quote-unquote fantasy and just go back to what fantasy is supposed to be before the 1960s, which is difficult. That sounds like a very absolutist thing to do. It sounds almost arbitrary. And it's difficult to kind of wrap your head around that when we've got so many decades of, you know, fantasy as a genre branching out into all these different things. But, you know, like with anything else, I feel like if we have to define a foundation, that's where it must begin.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it comes down to the point where I have to say that something is not fantasy, awkwardly and with much regret, maybe I would say it's not fantasy. I don't know. If we are adhering to this guideline that we're trying to define here. But it is, you know, it's a very difficult conversation to have at this point in the game.
Yeah, and what you get into with this is, you know, because a lot of stuff has been, you know, added on to and taken away from the core of fantasy over the years, especially, you know, like you said, beginning in the 1960s, you get to this point where the genre of fantasy is really kind of more the aesthetic of fantasy, because if you ask, like, the average person to define fantasy, they'll just start talking about, like, dragons and swords. And
that's right.
You know, while I guess that kind of works as a definition of an aesthetic of fantasy, it doesn't really work as anything beyond kind of an aesthetic. And I feel like the definition needs to be just kind of deeper than that. It can't just be has a dragon in it. Like, there has to be more to it than that, because otherwise, otherwise, what's the point? What's the point of categorizing things that way?
Yeah, it's like, you know, and that almost harkens back to what Crafty Matt was saying with Star Wars. It's like today, it's actually a very good comparison. So, today, a lot of folks will look at Star Wars and Star Trek as being science fiction, right? And what is the reason for that? It's because they have spaceships and laser guns and alien creatures and things like that. That's the aesthetic of a lot of science fiction, but it's not the core of what science fiction is about. And so when you actually look at it and you drill down into the meaning and the reason behind it, what it means, and the themes and the traditions of the genre, you start to realize that Star Trek is science fiction and Star Wars probably is not. Well, what is Star Wars then? Well, maybe it's fantasy, you know? So, you know, there is like a clear delineation that you can find by just examining the themes, understanding the history, going into what certain things have meant for, you know, the development of the genre. I would say modern fantasy, you know, obviously fantasy itself is thousands of years old. There, you know, we go back to fantasy stories from ancient Greece. But I would say like modern Western fantasy begins in like maybe the 1800s. Alice in Wonderland probably was one of the biggest successes. There was earlier pieces, of course, but, you know, I would recommend to anyone to read Tolkien's On Fairy Stories to get a deeper understanding of this, because he elucidates it far better than I ever could. He goes into deep detail about the history, origins, what it means, and what its highest function is. I would go there first, but we can certainly continue the conversation.
Yeah, to address what Robert Irwin and Orcus Dorcas are talking about in chat here, where, you know, the question of is Beowulf fantasy and then are the Scandinavian sagas fantasy, I would consider those, specifically the Scandinavian sagas, are kind of pre-fantasy. I would put them in the same category as Greek mythology, as influential to fantasy, but not, you know, fantasy is kind of taking those things and then crafting essentially modern narratives with that inspiration. You've got a thousand or more years of evolution in fiction before you get to what you would call fantasy at that point. And then Beowulf might be kind of the, like, patient zero of fantasy. I almost don't know where to put Beowulf in the conversation. I like to think of it as kind of the proto-fantasy story, along with the Arthurian saga. But, you know, these two things that you mentioned are precursors to fantasy and definitely belong in the conversation. But they're kind of like the missing link, almost like Orcus Dorcas is saying here. between mythology, historical narrative, and the modern fantasy story.
Right. If we are to assume that Beowulf was written by a Christian author, which it probably was, it probably was. There's some debate about whether it was an oral tradition that was simply jotted down by a Christian author, or whether it was someone who actually wrote and invented that story based on, you know, with some imaginative aspects to it. But if that's the latter case, then yeah, I would say it is maybe one of the earliest fantasy stories, because what it's doing is it's looking back to mythology at that time, which would have been considered pagan pre-Christian mythology, and bringing the elements from that to thrill and excite audience of that day, whether that was just an audience gathered around a campfire, or whether that was the court of some village, you know, something like that. But he's still bringing back the ideas of heroism, bravery. There is some element of good versus evil in Beowulf, along with fantastical elements like the dragon. So maybe it is. Maybe it is the first element of fantasy, but we can't know for sure without going back in time. And that's the problem with the Norse sagas and a lot of the pagan stuff. We don't know. I mean, people have a lot of very bold claims about paganism, whether the ancient Norse thought that the gods and goddesses and all these stories were real, or whether to them it was just metaphor, whether it was representational. We can't answer that question. People will say one way or the other. Varg says that it was, you know, there's all these people that will come out of the woodwork and have these claims about this, but we just don't know. We can never know.
Mm. And to answer another Orcus Dorcus question here, to help solidify the foundation, besides Tolkien and Lewis, who else would we cite as examples of traditional fantasy? I think Howard. Robert E. Howard is definitely in that conversation, because he brings in this idea of historical fiction in like a kind of a fantasized historical fiction to the world of Hyboria. I would say Howard Pyle is definitely in that conversation with his, with his artwork, but also with his compilation of the Merry Adventures of Robin Hood. That's a very influential text as far as traditional fantasy goes. That's also a good example of fantasy that does not have any kind of magical element in it.
Yeah.
I'd also consider the Arthurian cycles as traditional fantasy. And I would, I'd also throw Paul Anderson in there as a good example of someone who really understands what traditional fantasy is, specifically in Three Hearts, Three Lions, because that deals with a modern man being transported into the past to discover not just the roots of like his surroundings, but his personal roots and his roots to a very celebrated and well-regarded monarch and his court, not to give too much away for anyone who hasn't read that 80-year-old book.
An isekai.
Yeah.
So that's actually funny. I would consider isekai to be a very base level and accessible kind of version of understanding what fantasy is about, because it always includes someone from modern times being thrown into a historical mythological world and being forced to confront that world's values, and then taking something from that and using it to improve their life or improve the lives of others around them. A good example of fantasy, actually. But to add to that, I would also add The Will at the World's End by William Morris, 1896. Very influential to fantasy. It was H.G. Wells liked it. Tolkien was influenced by it. And also The King of Elfland's Daughter, 1924, by Ward Dunsany. And the things that these have in common is that, and this is something we've only touched on a little bit, is that they create their own worlds. And I feel like that is also kind of a core fantasy element for literature, at least, is what Tolkien called sub-creation, creating an believable world out of mythological and historical elements, where when you're reading it, it feels like you're reading it, you're not reading something that's just like seems ephemeral or false. It doesn't seem fake, is what I'm saying. Tolkien called that verisimilitude. You see that word tossed around a lot when people talk about fantasy as a genre. But yeah, I think fantasy as a whole should at least have some kind of element of sub-creation, where you're creating your own world to act as a foundation to present these ideas to the audience. And I feel like King of Elfland's Daughter, Will at World's End, and everything that Ryan Howard mentioned certainly falls into that category.
Mm. And yeah, Crafty, even with the High Crusade, I looking at the High Crusade, yes, it's Gonzo. It's Crusaders going into space. But there's an element of Paul Anderson in that book deals with how these people of a different era, of, you know, an era of the past, you know, the High Crusades in the 14th century, would deal with encountering, you know, extraterrestrials. So, yeah, it's Gonzo, but there's still this underpinning of traditionalism to it that I feel like, you know, puts Paul Anderson in the conversation there.
Yep, I would agree. What are some other concepts we want to talk about here?
Well, something that I want to talk about, and this kind of goes back to what Robert Irwin said earlier, where he said that conservative fantasy seems like an oxymoron. If we're defining, fantasy as conservative, we've kind of, you know, supposed that our, you know, presumptions about the genre are true. Let's kind of take the opposite side and, I guess, kind of try to falsify our theory here. So if fantasy is not conservative at its core, then what is it? I know we don't have a lot of time left, but with the time left that we have, let's try to take on that side of things. So if fantasy is not conservative, then how do you define it?
Let's think about that for a second. So if fantasy is not conservative, and keep in mind, we are kind of equating conservatism with traditionalism here.
Right.
We're not treating it as a political term. Is it imaginative? Does it use the power of imagination alone to posit improvements on the human condition? You could say that. It can certainly be pure imagination. It could, but that is too vague. I feel like that's far too vague, because that's all fiction, as you mentioned earlier. That's all fiction. Fiction is pure imagination. From horror to science fiction. What else could fantasy be? Could it be escapism? Pure escapism? Tolkien disagrees. Tolkien believes that elves were more real than human beings. He believes that they were more real than humans because they existed longer than humans. They've existed for thousands of years, and humans have ephemeral 70-year lifespans. So, I don't know if fantasy works if you consider it in those terms. What could it be? I think about it more and come up with more answers, but it would take some time. I really feel like You know, you're not going to get anywhere without defining fantasy in terms of the past, whether that's historical, Captain Picard, historical truth, personal truth, you know, that type of thing. Mm. It's like you've got to have some kind of truth there from history or mythology that you're reaching for. Legend, folklore offers a window into the human condition that is is eternal, right? There's stuff from 2,000 years ago that we look at. The Bible, common example. You can build fantasy by taking concepts from the Bible like many authors did. I think it just has that eternal aspect, that timelessness. It's a timelessness that defines it, really, if you get to the root, the spine. Like, it's got to have the timelessness. And there's a lot of stuff out there that calls itself fantasy that it does not draw upon any kind of timeless or eternal value system, that I feel like it just doesn't fit, it doesn't work.
Mm. Yeah, I struggle to figure out what else could kind of, you know, fill that position of traditionalism. If that's not it, if that's not the answer, you know, appealing to traditional values or historical truth isn't the, if that's not it, then how do you define it? And I'm seeing some people, you know, proffer some suggestions here. You know, fantasy equals adventure also, from Orcus Dorcas. That's true, but you can't solely define fantasy by adventure, because adventure slots into several other genres as well.
Yeah, I think adventure is simply the means by which that fantasy authors generate their audience, right? Mm-hmm. They have fantasy as the foundation of the genre that they're writing in. They use adventure in order to build the story. So it's mm-hmm. a storytelling structure, really.
Right. And then Jack Hull says fantasy could be fantastical elements within a recognizable world that makes sense to us.
That's verisimilitude.
Yeah, and the questions that I have here is, how do you define fantastical elements, and what would make them unique enough to essentially differentiate the fantastical elements that you find in fantasy from the ones that you find in like, you know, science fiction, which certainly has fantastical elements of its own in a way that allows you to separate genres from each other. And then also, what makes a world recognizable? I would say that it has to appeal to some kind of truth. And I think that's kind of what we're getting at here, is there has to be a, you know, all fiction has to appeal to something true. Otherwise, it's not recognizable to us. We have to be able to recognize something in the story as part of our world, part of the human world. Otherwise, it's not going to make any sense to us, and we're not going to be able to ingest it. And then another one from Orcus Dorcas, it allows us to enter a world of contrasts and opposites to break away from the entrapment of realism. To me, that almost seems like a definition of fiction, more so than fantasy.
Yeah. Allows us to enter a world of contrasts and opposites. From the outset, from someone looking in as a reader or an audience member, that might seem true. If you're just a human being looking into a world of goblins, then you've got your base standard, which is Earth. You've got, you're living in the real world, and then you have the goblin world, and that's, you know, positive and negative. You've got your opposites there. But again, as I mentioned briefly, Tolkien, I hate to go back to Tolkien, but he is the master. Certainly knows more about fantasy than me, has said that things like goblins and elves are more real than human beings, and then more real than the human experience. They come from the human experience. They don't exist outside of that, but because of the fact that they are eternal, the fact that they exist through thousands of years in our consciousness and our cultural consciousness, not just as Westerners who descend from Europeans, or even if you're European who has that in your cultural background. And so these concepts, these ideas, they live beyond us. After we're dead, goblins will still be there, right? So they're technically more real to us, is what Tolkien is trying to say there. So I don't think there's as much of a contrast, ultimately, as we would expect.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got in real trouble when I mentioned that, you know, fantasy races come from different aspects of kind of the human condition, and are those kind of amplified without the other factors that make humans human. I was actually called a white supremacist for suggesting that, which doesn't make any sense to me.
It's perfectly true. Reminds me of the latest drama about Baldur's Gate 3, where apparently Baldur's Gate 3, which is a 100% 5th edition game, like, it is pure. Wizards of the Coast was involved in this shit. Like, they oversaw some of this. If you are a tiefling, people are racist to you throughout the entire game. You can, and like this, there's like evil races and things like that. And, you know, it doesn't go as far as something like I would do with, you know, the Chronicles of Iris, where races are intended to mean specific thematic elements. But it's, you know, it's still there. It's part of a cultural consciousness that, as much as modern pundits would like to erase, will always exist, and it has a reason for existing. And that's another facet of fantasy. It will always have themes that have a reason for existing, cannot be erased, and that's because they lie in history and mythology. That's really, that's another point that it boils down to.
Yeah, so unfortunately we're at our time, and there's a lot more that I feel like needs to be said about this. We didn't even get into the kind of, you know, traditional values of heroism that I feel are necessary. There's just so much more to talk about this. There might have to be a part two at some point.
Sure. I wouldn't be opposed to it.
And if we do a part two, I might, you know, bring in a couple people, maybe even someone who you know, disagrees with us, just for a kind of a balanced perspective. But yeah, I mean, I feel like this conversation is far from over.
A part two would be good. I'd like to just deposit an idea. Most of our audience are tabletop role-playing game guys.
Yeah.
I would be not opposed to discussing the concept in the context of tabletop role-playing.
Yeah.
You know, what fantasy means there. Why are we playing fantasy games? Why are we constantly drawn to fantasy games, Dungeons and Dragons, over other things? Is it because the eternality of the themes appeal to us inherently as, you know, people of a certain culture? Like, I feel that must be the case. But we can talk about that more at some point in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get out of here, is there anything you want to plug? I'm going to go ahead and drop in chat right now the link to your Drive-Thru RPG page for Dueling Dragon Adventures. This is where you guys can find stuff like Chronicles of Iris and all of the associated adventures and source books. Is there anything else you want to promote while you're on here?
No. Yeah. No, yeah. Sorry. So yeah, a quick thing, if you take a look at my Drive-Thru RPG, our newest product is the Wilderkind. It's a small supplement for Castles and Crusades, introducing animal-like races influenced by Redwall. And even though Redwall was written after 1980, sorry Jeffro, it actually does have a lot of eternal themes, very Christian author and Brian Jakes, high heroism, all of the books have strong good versus evil themes. Very classical fantasy in the vein of Tolkien. Definitely check out Redwall. It is more for a younger audience, but it's awesome. And personally, I am working on a non-fantasy project, which is a kaiju versus mecha tabletop war game RPG. I've been working on that for a year now. It's going a little bit slow, but we're getting there. And yeah, don't expect any highfalutin fantasy themes in that. That's going to be a post-apocalyptic cyberpunk throwback to the 80s with Mad Max and Blade Runner and all that. Godzilla, so that's what I got. Follow me on Twitter at Iris Chronicles if you want to check it out.
Absolutely. Well, Greg, thanks again for coming on. And yeah, we're going to do this again. And next time we're going to, I'll go ahead and say next time we come back to this topic, we should bring on someone who disagrees with us just to add that element to the conversation.
No, I'll get my bottle of Jack Daniels ready.
All right, well, guys, that's going to do it for Rolling Bones tonight. Next week, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen here just to show you guys what we'll be talking about next week, because DM Blackwall is coming back on Rolling Bones, and this time his game Horde Wars Basic is available. It launched last week. It's available on Big Geek Emporium, and it is built around fighting large hordes of enemies. So if you guys want to hear more about that, if you want to check it out, you can find it on Big Geek Emporium. I've had whiskey tonight, so I can't talk. But we will have DM Blackwall back on the show next week to talk all about this lovely book here. And also next Thursday, I will be doing some recording with my good friend Legacy Game Mastering. I'm not sure when that'll be available, but he and I will be doing another collaboration, and that will be showing up on his channel whenever he's ready for it. So be on the lookout for that. And if you missed my conversation with the guys over at Grail Country, we had a very similar conversation to the one that we had tonight. I will go ahead and drop that link here in chat as well. And that one was mostly around my theories about how Kierkegaard and fantasy kind of interact with each other. So again, if you liked the tone of the conversation that Greg and I had tonight, I believe you will enjoy this video of me over on Grail Country. So next week, DM Blackwall will be back. And until then, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I am so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.
See ya.